This is an ABC podcast.
Today we head to Timber Creek in the Northern Territory, where a lack of safe houses for victims of domestic violence is leaving remote communities at risk.
A lot of families are still catering for the victim, you know, like shifting the victim to another house for time being, and then you're putting yourself at risk. Then we've been crying out for, you know, 20 something odd years now. Yeah, far too long.
And tradies undertake training to help tackle the high rates of suicide in the construction industry.
Most of us being male, like, we're probably not the best talkers, and I'm probably exactly the same. So yeah, things like this help, and if other people start, hopefully that would help people talk a bit more.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk country. In many small towns across Australia, the pub is often a focal point. It's where people gather for a yarn to celebrate and have a few drinks. Gathering in the pub stopped for a number of Queensland Indigenous communities in the 2000s when the state government introduced alcohol management plans as a means of reducing alcohol-fuelled violence. Still today, many communities face strict restrictions on the possession and the sale of alcohol. Kawanyama on Western Cape York was one of the hardest hit by the restrictions, but it was also one of the first to reopen a licensed premises in 2014. This year, the community reached another milestone and is a further step closer to enjoying the same liberties as the rest of Australia. But as Mark Rigby reports, those liberties are having some unintended consequences.
To buy a drink at the Kawanyama canteen, you've got to blow in the bag, and you've got to return a zero reading. The Western Cape York town was one of seven Indigenous communities across Queensland where prohibition was introduced in the late 2000s. In 2022, 8 years after the canteen reopened, the community has gained more freedom regarding alcohol, successfully applying for a takeaway licence. But that freedom is still restricted. Each customer is limited to 12 mid-strength drinks per evening, and only from Wednesday to Saturday between 5 and 11 p.m. Just to enter the canteen, patrons must sign in, take a breathalyzer test, return a zero reading, even to buy takeaways. They can then, for example, have 4 drinks at the bar and take 8 home. They can have 2 at the bar and take 10 home. Canteen regular Clive Smokey Gilbert says since takeaways became available again, many are abandoning the bar and taking their full measure home to drink.
You get hardly any people in the canteen. They all go home, they take the beer home, 2 couple of 6. There's a lot of change in that. No takeaway was on this pub, it's some crowded every, you know, paydays, you know, council payday, all that. But you don't see it now, they'll always be going home now. People enjoy the beer home, you know, watch football home. Especially when it gets cool in the night, but too cold for the people, you know, they go straight home. Yeah.
Most in Kawanyama welcome the return of the canteen's takeaway licence, including the town's women's support group. Locals, including Smokey, say having fewer people in the pub has meant fewer fights and instances of antisocial behaviour.
Something good for the community anyway. Keep them out of trouble. Yeah.
For Michael Yam, a former mayor of the Kawanyama Aboriginal Shire Council, the return of takeaway alcohol sales at the canteen is a return of the rights and responsibilities of the townspeople.
I think the canteen is a pretty good thing, you know. By time they gave us something back, you know. I mean, they introduced alcohol to us in the first place, then they took it away and that, but that's because they made the mistake. Because they had no rehabilitation centre around teaching people how to drink, and especially people first time drinking, and that they're not going to know anything or what effect it does to you, and that them things should have been in place in the first place. Then they took it away and then gave it back. But it's a good thing giving it back to us, you know. Probably minimise sly grogging and that, you know. As we know in our community, there's always opportunities there, and that they're going to do sly grogging. You won't stop it.
And Michael Yam says the ability for some in the community to drink away from the pub is providing other benefits for the town's younger residents.
Some family can take a takeaway home so they can be home with their kids and that, you know, instead of drinking in the club all the time. Away from their little ones, you know. But we need to work as a collective within our community and and deal with this issue, you know, before it gets worse. So we can get our kids to school so we can educate them, you know, because they're the next generation to be running the community. I mean, we're not going to be around forever and that.
Michael Yan, Kawanyama resident and former mayor of the local Aboriginal Shire Council, rounding out that story from Mark Rigby. And it's worth reading that story on ABC online as well. It's really interesting.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
And you're with me, Sinead Mangan. Rising construction costs and a national tradie shortage have led to mounting pressure on the sector to keep up with demand. But behind the scaffolding, construction workers have also been battling concerning suicide rates. Now tradies in South Australia's regions are picking up a new set of tools to tackle this issue and help their mates who might be struggling. And a content warning, the following contains references to suicide. Sophie Lando has the story.
Work sites are full of potential hazards that tradies are well trained to keep an eye out for. They've got the gear to protect themselves and make sure each other is safe on site. But there's one hazard which is harder to spot, but knowing how to stop it in its tracks could save lives. Research from suicide prevention charity and training group Mates in Construction found tradies are 6 times more likely to die from suicide than an accident at work. And for younger construction workers, well, they're 3 times more likely to take their own lives than other young Australians. Mates in Construction case manager and field officer Patrick Cookler says there's a few factors contributing to these stats.
The construction industry has a fairly common strain of long working hours, the threat of redundancy quite often, the work gets switched on and off a fair bit. There are always issues around personal safety, physical safety as well. There's often a culture of really not talking about their issues, their mental health issues particularly, with each other or with anybody else, or even getting that sort of professional help. So any kind of help that we can give them to overcome those barriers really helps, I think, them and helps us all to bring those difficult statistics down.
Mates in Construction want to change this trend by delivering practical suicide prevention training to tradies. Field officer Matt Carter says suicide prevention is a work health and safety issue, and breaking down the stigma is a big part of the training.
Toughing it out does take its toll, that's for sure, and the idea that we are supposed to push through our pain and be men as a male-dominated industry, it does take its toll mentally, and we're not travelling so well either. We're not so good at helping each other. It doesn't work. I guess the statistics speak for themselves when we do try and tough it out. And so our part of our role is trying to model or demonstrate the points at which we do start that conversation, make it okay to talk about the stuff that would otherwise be sort of either frowned upon or there's some shame attached to it, embarrassment, lots of stigma around it. So we kind of model the idea that it's okay to sort of raise this stuff and then that you're not weak.
In a recent trip to Berry in South Australia's Riverland, they trained more than 40 tradies and subcontractors from construction group Michael Krieger Building. They gathered around the campfire, fuelled themselves with coffee and egg and bacon rolls, and got stuck into addressing the challenging topic. Tradies learned about key moments to check in on a mate, like noticing they're coming in late or have a change in mood, are socially withdrawn or are using drugs and alcohol more. After identifying these warning signs, they learned practical tools on how to triage their mates to get help and continue that open dialogue on site. Apprentice carpenter Hugo Krieger says he and his workmates need to start the conversation.
I think definitely touching on, well, having an open discussion on mental health, yeah, it's really important in the construction industry. As the stats show that, so I thought it was really important that we should open the discussion and, you know, raise the problem. We had a good turnout here today, having an egg and bacon roll and a coffee and, yeah, so it should be good. Everyone should get something out of it.
Mark Kozjak is director of Berry-based company MWK Electrical, and he says as a team leader, it's crucial for him to promote honest conversations around mental health.
Most of us being male, like, we're probably not the best talkers, and I'm probably exactly the same. So, yeah, things like this help, and if other people start, hopefully that would help. people talk a bit more, because yeah, it's a lot of pressures and you don't know what people are going through behind the scenes, which is probably the toughest thing.
Mr. Kozjak says talking about suicide prevention openly will help fight the idea that they need to tough it out. And this training will be sitting right next to the hard hat and the high vis to help keep his mates safe on site.
A couple of the boys that they'd say, oh, like, you know, I haven't had the best day, this was happening. And you know, I just try and say, like, you're not having the best day. Like, if you're not mentally fit to come, you don't have to come. Like, or you can talk to us and that type of thing. Don't feel like, I think sometimes they feel like they're pressured. Like, we put pressure on them, and we're probably, all our bosses are probably guilty of that at some stage. But yeah, I just try and tell them that if you're not up to it, like, just, yeah, let us know.
Mark Kozjak, the director of Bury-based company MWK Electrical, and he finished off that story from Sophie Landau. And if you or someone you know needs support, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. That's 13 11 14.
You're listening to Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
From giving your time at the local school canteen to showing up after a natural disaster, over the years, Australians have been happy to offer a helping hand. But in recent years, the number of people volunteering has plummeted across Australia. It's causing some community events to be cancelled and stretching emergency services, particularly in regional areas where volleys are often the first to respond. The situation is prompting soul-searching around whether Australians have become too selfish or we're just too stretched for time to volunteer, or whether it's a temporary dip in response to the COVID pandemic. The ABC's drilled down on the data and it's revealed it's young people who've dropped out of volunteering at the highest rate. Regional Social Affairs reporter Erin Park has more.
It's training time for the Broome Sea Rescue Unit.
Reversing.
And its volunteer crew is hitting the water.
Powering up. Holding on.
Every few weeks, the crew is called out, often in the middle of the night, to help a sinking or stranded vessel. Volunteer skipper Gareth Owen says it's an essential service.
Generally, the waters are very safe. But once you have a breakdown or the weather catches you unawares, then the only people who are going to come out and find you is Marine Rescue Broome. So it's vital that we're able to crew the vessel.
Ropes clear, please go forward slowly.
But keeping enough trained and willing volunteers on call is a challenge.
It's always very close. We have a major problem because we're quite low on numbers.
The Broome Sea Rescue Unit has been able to maintain volunteer numbers with the assistance of a government-funded recruitment campaign. But nationally, many organisations are struggling. The latest data shows in recent years there's been an almost 20% reduction in the number of Australians who are choosing to volunteer. ABS data shows volunteering rates have been in gradual decline, but dropped precipitously during the COVID pandemic. Social commentator Hugh McKay says it reflects a broader erosion of social cohesion, with Australians reporting they're busier than ever, spending more time on social media and accustomed to staying at home during the COVID pandemic.
So here's the odd, really paradoxical thing, that we are born to connect, we're born to be together, and yet we've been through this hugely disruptive period of social change, which has pushed us in the opposite direction. So that's been bad news for volunteering.
And one of the biggest changes has been in the attitudes and lifestyles of millennials, who it appears aren't as willing to make a long-term commitment to volunteering. But they're not the only ones. All age brackets are now more reluctant to put up their hand to help out.
Human history is littered with examples of how much we love bashing younger generations. Why don't they have our values? Why don't they live like us? But in fact, these social trends that have been fragmenting us, making us more individualistic. This has been across, this is not generational, this is societal.
Volunteering Australia says the onus will be on charities and community groups to adapt by recruiting people for one-off events or maybe drawing on a larger pool of occasional participants. Here's Chief Executive Mark Pearce.
The real challenge for a number of organisations, long-established organisations, is to listen to community, listen to volunteers, and change programs and the way that they engage volunteers into community as we move forward.
The decline has been most keenly felt in regional areas, where some community events have had to be cancelled.
Among them is the Broome Dragon Boat Regatta. The event normally raises tens of thousands of dollars for charity, but this year there weren't enough people to organise or run it. Mark Pearce from Volunteering Australia says it's a worrying trend.
The practical impact of lower volunteering rates, especially in remote and regional Australia, has really significant implications for the livability of the communities in which people spend their lives.
Out on the ocean, the stricken vessel training exercise is wrapping up. There has been a small uptick in volunteer participation this year since COVID lockdowns lifted, but so far not enough to ease the load.
Because, you know, you see so many awesome volunteers doing things, you know, particularly the floods and the firefighters, eastern states, people forget that they are volunteers. Actually, it's, you know, it's part of the service that we get for being Australian and not realising that it's actually ourselves that we need to look after each other.
Erin Park reporting there from Broome in Western Australia, and having spent lots of time on the side of a footy field or in a canteen, hope everybody gets into it again.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
In many communities across the remote Northern Territory, dedicated shelters provide women in crisis with safety from the nation's worst rates of domestic violence. But one vast outback region just east of the West Australian border has gone without, leaving victims with few places to turn. Jessie Thompson reports.
Morning, Marilla.
Hi, Kat.
How are we going?
In the Timber Creek Health Clinic, a small team works hard to keep vulnerable Indigenous patients safe from harm.
Let's pop into my office. We'll just have a quick look at those staff figures.
But when clinic coordinator Catherine Drummond treated a woman who'd been beaten by her partner earlier this year, she found herself with the coalface of a glaring problem.
It potentially looked like we were going to have to return her to her home because she couldn't identify anywhere else that was safe.
Despite acting as a service hub for many communities in the vast outback region linking Catherine to the East Kimberley, there's no women's shelter in Timber Creek. The closest dedicated safe space is hours of driving away, leaving frontline services with no obvious place to turn.
And that created some stress for me. I had long conversations with the police about, like, what is this going to look like? Is this a safe option? And I don't think it was a safe option. It was virtually the only option for her.
In the tiny community of Myatt, on the outskirts of Timber Creek, many of the homes have become overnight safe houses at some point in the past.
A lot of family are still catering for the victim, you know, like shifting the victim to another house for a time being, and then you're putting yourself at risk.
Ngalliwuru and Noongali woman Lorraine Jones says she first began taking domestic violence victims in as a community police officer in the 1990s. Decades later, her sister Deborah says little has changed.
Try and explain to the children who's the victim is, where they come from. The kids would ask, what are they doing here in our house?
Police and nurses also occasionally leave the town for entire working days to escort victims to a shelter about 300 kilometres away. NT Police provided the ABC with statistics showing domestic violence incidents increasing in the region over the past few years. Superintendent Kirk Panuto says the matters are also generally becoming more severe.
When we're talking about things potentially increasing in severity over time, my initial view would be that we are definitely leaving community more often than perhaps we have in the past.
The federal government has spent tens of millions of dollars on women's shelters in remote communities across the NT over the past decade, but it's the Northern Territory government that chooses where they go. A spokesperson said that decision comes down to staffing, funding and overall rates of violence. Local Mayor Brian Pedwell is more blunt. He says the issue is being bounced between tiers of government like a handball.
You can only write so many letters, you know, to all these ministers, but it doesn't really hit them in the core, you know.
His deputy, Shirley Garlett, who lives in Timber Creek, says many locals have begun to feel like they're flogging a dead horse, even as domestic violence rages on.
It's an issue because we're losing people. People are dying and committing suicide, and we can stop that if we had, you know, if we had the right place.
NT Domestic Violence Minister Kate Warden says there's just one thing stopping a shelter being built.
To set up a service in Timber Creek, that would be an ideal outcome, and we'd like to do something like that straight away. You actually need funding, and that's why we are calling on the Commonwealth to assist us.
The Minister will make a formal request for millions of dollars in additional Commonwealth funding soon, after the issue was thrust into the spotlight following the deaths of two Indigenous women and an infant in alleged domestic and family violence incidents in the NT last month alone. Whether that funding eventually flows to Timber Creek remains to be seen, but it couldn't come soon enough for locals like Lorraine Jones, forced to take matters into their own hands for far too long.
And we've been crying out for, 20-something odd years now. Yeah, far too long.
Lorraine Jones finishing up that story from Northern Territory reporter Jesse Thompson, who was in Timber Creek.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
I didn't know Melbourne much. I knew where the racecourses were.
I'm making signs for the sleepy lizards.
Basically less eggs this year than what we would have expected.
The houses that are near the edge of the bush, they might encounter a snake up to 4 times a year, a death adder.
See how it goes.
On ABC Radio.
And to finish off the programme today, we're going to hear from Australia's oldest person, Frank Moore. He lives with his son Philip in the beautiful old town of Central Tilba in New South Wales, and the town itself is listed by the National Trust. Frank Moore has 110 birthday candles on his cake today, making him Australia's oldest person.
Frank Moore has always lived life to the fullest.
I live day by day.
The 110-year-old says he's seen it all, surviving 2 world wars, 2 global pandemics, and the tragic deaths of dear loved ones. But in between the tough moments, he has also experienced pleasure, with 6 children, 13 grandchildren, and 24 great-grandchildren. For someone who has lived a challenging life as long as Frank, his optimism is no easy task. His brother died of the Spanish flu at the age of 20, and in the years that followed, he lost his mother, left school, and was separated from his siblings.
And that broke up the home. We became wards of the state.
Despite having to grow up so quickly, there are still moments he remembers fondly.
I worked on the farm, rode horses, did some stupid things, like swimming in the sea, on the horse, jumping over park rails, thinking I was having fun.
It was during this boisterous adolescence that Frank met his Irish wife, Elizabeth Moore. The two were married before the outbreak of the Second World War in 1939. After the wedding, as a conscientious objector, Frank refused to partake in the bloodshed of World War II.
I became interested in religion when I was about 18. And the concept was that you don't take up arms or shoot anybody.
Frank and Elizabeth spent over 70 years married to each other before illness would separate them. Elizabeth was diagnosed with dementia shortly before she died of breast cancer in 2012. In the years before her death, it was Frank who looked after her.
She didn't want to be cooped up in the unit, and she'd get out occasionally. And then I'll have to go look for him, find her in somebody else's house.
Losing his sweetheart was one of his great challenges when it was finally time to say goodbye.
She was my life partner. We had a great marriage. I had no regrets, but I'll miss her.
Now, Frank lives with his 73-year-old son, Philip Moore, in Central Tilba in South Coast, New South Wales. Philip and his partner, Stuart, are his carers. Some days are harder than others.
He needs a lot of care and assistance, so that is a full-time job for 2 of us.
Despite this, Philip finds living with his father later in life to be a privilege.
He's remarkably stoic, and he'll put up with a lot of discomforts, and he won't complain. You know, he doesn't see the negative side of things. Generally speaking, he always looks to the good, and he wants to live.
Happy birthday, Frank Moore, 110 years old today, and that was Philip Moore, his son. And that's Australia-wide for this Monday. Remember, you can listen to the programme anytime you like on the Listen app. And while you're there, why don't you hit subscribe? We'd really appreciate it if you did. I'm Sinead Mangan. Have a lovely evening. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.